This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. Futuro.
From Futuro Media, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today, a conversation with a Cuban-American Democrat who grew up in Los Angeles, became a police chief, and now is a progressive prosecutor. District Attorney George Gascon. George Gascon was born in Cuba in the 1950s, though at that time, he wasn't called George.
No, they named me Jorge. But then I went in the army and people kept spelling my name G-O-R-G-E, and I finally relented.
Gascon moved with his family to Los Angeles County when he was 13. He held on to his native language, but his Cuban Spanish started to change.
I grew up around Mexicans more than I did around Cubans. So actually, when I'm around Mexicans, I sound less and less like a Cuban. I have to be around Cubans for a few hours before I begin to sound Cuban again.
Gascon adapted to his new home. And as a young man, he joined the Los Angeles Police Department. Now, he's making headlines for reasons that you might not expect from someone who spent decades as a police officer. Gascon was recently elected as district attorney for Los Angeles County, which is the largest local prosecutor's office in the country. And his victory has been hailed as a major win for a movement of progressive prosecutors who want to end mass incarceration and overhaul the United States law enforcement system from the inside. Gascon has had a circuitous journey from beat cop to top prosecutor. After rising through the ranks at the LAPD and earning a law degree, he moved to Mesa, Arizona, where he served as police chief. Then he moved to San Francisco, where he also served as police chief, until he was appointed to replace Kamala Harris as district attorney in 2011. While he was there, he co-authored California's Proposition 47, which reclassified many nonviolent and drug crimes from felonies to misdemeanors, which significantly reduced the state's prison population. Gascon has been called the godfather of progressive prosecutors. I sat down with him just a few days before he took the reins of his home city's district attorney's office to talk about his upbringing in Los Angeles, how being a police officer has shaped his view of criminal justice, and what his vision is for his new job. George Gascon, welcome to Latino USA.
Maria, how are you? ¿Cómo estás?
So you are born in truly one of the most fabulous cities of the world.
Thank you.
It is. Havana is just one of the most extraordinary cities of the world. You're growing up there as a little kid. I can't even imagine what that's like. It's the early years of the Cuban Revolution.
Yep.
And when you're 13 years old, your family leaves Cuba altogether and you move to, how is it said? Carahey. Which is a suburb of Los Angeles.
Yeah, we call it more a barrio.
Oh, it's like a barrio.
Yeah, there's not much of a suburb in LA.
I got you. So what was it like then to go from Havana to, as you say, a barrio of Los Angeles?
Yeah, you know, it was interesting because I grew up in a poor neighborhood in La Habana. My father was a factory worker. He worked for a beer brewery. He was a mechanic. He had been a revolutionary, fighting Batista. In fact, he almost dying. He was left for dead as a young man by the Batista police. And then he became an anti-Castro guy. But we lived in a very, very blue-collar neighborhood. Of course, as you well know, Cuba's fully integrated. So, you know, we had Black Cubans, white Cubans, Chinese. So it was a very integrated environment. And then when we got to Cartagena, we were one of the first few Latino families. Mostly they were poor whites. So the kids that I went to school, by and large, were poor whites. The socioeconomic part of it really didn't hit me because I came from a place that, quite frankly, by comparison, was even probably poorer. Although we had a lot more freedom as kids to run around the streets and be ourselves, which is not quite the same in this country.
In fact, you have said that when you're this kid, this Spanish-speaking kid in a poor white barrio, that the police were not necessarily good to you. It was not necessarily officer-friendly, the person who you were interacting with. And what was your understanding? Was your understanding, again, like, they're picking on me because I speak Spanish or because I'm different, or they just pick on everybody in our community because we're poor? What was your analysis of why the police were doing this?
What happens is Cartagena became Latino very, very quickly. I think we just came maybe at the tail end of that being primarily poor white to very quickly started to turn poor, mostly Mexican. And, you know, when I was 13, I didn't quite get, I mean, the police was not an issue. It really became more so by the time I turned 16, you know, and I started to drive and started to mix with other kids. And, you know, I remember my dad had a 63 Impala that he was going to trade in, and I got it for him, and I lowered the car. So I had a lowrider, and all of a sudden we're, you know, I'm becoming.
You had a lowrider?
I had a lowrider.
Wait
rider.
A second. And did you soup it up?
I dropped it. I didn't put any hydraulics on it. I didn't have the money. Hydraulics were expensive.
So what's your favorite song from that moment when you think of the lowrider driving around? Do you have one that you're
well,
like?
Well, I tell you one, and it came out a little later, and it was, it's Lowrider is the name of the song. And I got the group.
Oh, you mean War?
War, of course. That was just like.
It's the one that goes Lowrider.
Yeah.
Rider.
Yeah, that was my national anthem.
So is that in part why the police would kind of target you? Because you had dropped your car and you were listening to some loud music.
I think it was definitely the drop the car. And that was before I had gray hair. So I had, you know, I had deep black hair. Even though I'm fairly light complected, you know, I definitely looked, you know, Latino at the time, more so than I would today. And then, you know, I hang around with other kids that were brown, and you know, we went to East LA and we drove around Wheater Boulevard. So it was, you know, probably a combination of all the things.
So did you understand that you were being targeted by the police? Is that how your young mind understood that? And what was your mind at that age thinking about the police? Were you thinking like, oh my God, here they come again? Or were you thinking like, I want to be one?
No, we definitely felt targeted, and I did not want to be one. And, you know, we look for every way to avoid it. And frankly, I mean, certainly if I was driving and a black and white came anywhere near, you know, it was like, oh, shit, I'm going to get jacked up. And most of the time I was right. And it didn't matter what I did. You know, I could be going speed limit. It really didn't matter. I would get stopped because I'm going too slow. I'm going to stop because I, quote unquote, rolled through a stop sign. I mean, you know, it's all the bullshit. And if I was on, like, you know, around Whittier Boulevard on the weekends or something, you knew you were going to get, it was almost like it was hard to imagine that either you or one of your friends was not going to be stopped before the night was over.
Interestingly, even though, you know, you have this pretty extraordinary position back then, you drop out of high school. You were, in fact, one of those statistics, you know, yeah. Latinos dropping out of high school. You joined the army. Yeah. Then you go to college. So what happens where you were like, no, I'm not going to become that. But then after the army and you come back, and you're like, OK, I think I'm going to do that.
I go in the army. I wound up, you know, doing well. You know, frankly, the army for me, it was a great move. I think most of the kids that I grew up with. You know, they sort of never, when I say this, they never left the neighborhood. I say that on a way that just, you know, it sort of trapped them, and they wound up, you know, sometimes getting arrested, you know, getting in trouble. For me, the Army was it gave me an opportunity to break away, and I was going to Cal State Long Beach finishing my bachelor degree, and I had a friend of mine that had joined the LAPD a few months before, maybe like a half a year before, and he was talking about how proud he felt about the work and how exciting he found it, and you know, the capacity to do good work in communities that were very similar to the ones that we grew up in, and that really kind of what sort of tipped me over. I was intending to be a teacher, frankly, history teacher, and I was newly married, and we were planning to have kids, and cops made more money than teachers, which continues to be the case, which, by the way, really shows how screwed up we're a society where police make more than teachers. Not that police is not an important work, but I find that, you know, that is probably an indication of just how wrong our priorities are from time to time.
You were actually a police officer for more than 30 years before you become a district attorney.
Right.
So what were your main takeaways from all of those years of policing in terms of the criminal justice system and how it works?
So, you know, within my own evolution in policing, I came to the conclusion that we were incarcerating way too many people, that we were destroying one generation after another, poor, mainly Black and brown people. And the more that I read, the more that I learned, the more that I became convinced that there was no data, no science to support that actually this made us any safer. In fact, arguably, it made us less safe, because what occurs is when you get young people into the criminal justice system, you criminalize them early on, you basically foreclose all the other options because you give them a criminal record so they cannot get housing, schooling, and other things. And often they are left with very little option but to go back to doing things illegally. And so what you do is you increase the recidivism rate and you reduce the safety, and then you create this incredible social cost to this mass incarceration movement and an economic cost too. So I became very anti-mass incarceration. And when Gavin Newsom offered me the job when Kamala Harris became the attorney general, I was very singularly focused in being able to show that you can lower incarceration and increase community safety. And that was really my goal.
Coming up on Latino USA, I talk with George Gascon about creating a blueprint for the progressive prosecutor movement and what law enforcement should look like during a pandemic. Stay with us. No te vayas.
Support for Latino USA comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/latino. That's odoo.com/latino. Odoo. Modern management made simple. Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, we're back. And before the break, I was speaking with the new Los Angeles County District Attorney, George Gascon, about how his background as a Cuban-American teenager in LA and then as a police officer has shaped his philosophy of law enforcement. Now we're going to turn to Gascón's time as a district attorney in San Francisco and talk about what it looks like to put his philosophy into action. Let's get back to the conversation. You do make a lot of changes as a district attorney in the office in San Francisco. You create restorative justice programs. You stop fining homeless people for things like sleeping on the sidewalk. You co-author California's Proposition 47 in 2014, which was a big deal because it reclassified most nonviolent property and drug crimes from felonies to misdemeanors. And this is huge for young men of color. So at this point, were you beyond mass incarceration? Were you thinking like there's a whole other thing that's going on here? How did you understand your philosophy behind these efforts?
Yeah, you know, so as I evolve in my own process as a district attorney, I'm you know, facing the fact that you can walk away from that mass incarceration is really driven by race. And so then I started to not pivot away from looking for ways to reduce incarceration because that continued to be a focus. But then the issue of the impact, the interaction between race and the criminal justice system became more and more part of my focus, if you will, and my attention. And that was sort of an evolution for me. It didn't happen immediately when I was a district attorney. And then, you know, frankly, looking at the impact that we knew the Proposition 47 was going to have, that not only was it going to be a big decarcerator, but it was more than just being a decarcerator. It's going to be a major decarcerator of Black and brown people, which it turned out to be, by the way. There were studies that were done that have clearly concluded that the biggest impact, especially on African-American incarceration rates, was Prop 47, you know, in the state.
Wow. So when you stepped down as the DA from San Francisco, violent crime in the city was at its lowest rate in half a century.
Right.
So that's pretty incredible. On the other hand, property crimes like car break-ins had gone up almost 40%. And, you know, you've been criticized for that, kind of like, oh, your progressive policies aren't working here. So you have studied this. You have looked at the data. What do you understand in terms of the cause of crime and why it goes up and down? And what role does your work as a district attorney ultimately have to do with that?
So a couple of components. Number one, after Prop 47, many police departments decided that they were going to show people like me and the public that they were going to come to a work slowdown. So in San Francisco, property crime was vastly driven by car break-ins. We have 81,000 car break-ins. There are 13 arrests. There is no way that you can control anything by a lack of police intervention. By the way, police intervention doesn't mean that you have to incarcerate people, but somebody has to come in and stop things, and then we have to assess what do we do to intervene. But to the second point that you make, and what is the role of a district attorney in this arena, I think that we need to begin to recognize as a society that the criminal justice system has very limited application when it comes to dealing with the causes of crime. When we jump into a situation, we're basically coming in because everything else failed, right? So we need to understand that if we want to stop or if we want to reduce, especially when you're talking about, you know, property crimes and crimes of poverty, you need to start much earlier than that by providing the resources and the early interventions and the opportunities that are going to move people away from the likelihood of breaking into a car and going and doing something else. We have to provide enough mental health services to make sure that people that are suffering from mental health are going to have a place to go. We need to make sure that housing becomes a right, not necessarily a privilege for some. These are all the things that we have to invest as a society if we want to create a safer community. But what we did about 35, 40 years ago is we decided, you know, we're at a fork with the epidemic of crack. And, you know, some countries decided to look at it through a public health like Portugal did. And we decided to put our criminal justice system on, you know, afterburners. And we built a lot of prisons. We shut down schools. We shut down hospitals. You know, we defunded public education. We defunded mental health and public health. And we took that money and put it into the law enforcement prison bucket. And we're now paying the price of that.
You're about to take over as the district attorney in Los Angeles County at a time when there has been an increase in violent crime. Violent crime has been a problem in cities across the country this year, sadly. So what is your role in terms of taking this on as a progressive DA in this moment?
Yeah, I think, look, my role is going to be a thoughtful partner to our public health officials, to be a thoughtful partner to our social services, to our community-based organizations, and make sure that we start working together. Look, there's always going to be a place for prosecution and jailing and prison for some people. The question is, what is the right size of that? And when do we use that very aggressive intervention that generally has a lot of bad effects? So my role will be one of, you know, bringing people together to create local solutions that are going to address our problems and hopefully start creating blueprints that we can learn from and take to other parts of the country. And above all, you know, not to engage in the tough on crime rhetoric that can sort of start unwinding the progress that we have made. Unquestionably, homicides have gone up in many parts of the country. But I think it's important to realize also that there are many forces at play right now. You know, we're going through this horrible pandemic. You know, there are a lot of social issues that are happening at the same time. And I think that we have to be a little careful and jump to any conclusions and try to, you know, attach any particular meaning to policies to answer for the fact that we've had a jump in homicides in many major cities. Sociologists and criminologists are going to be studying this decades from now. And what we have to do is make sure that we do not take the easy road and immediately try to start demonizing one part of our community as the way to try to, quote unquote, fix the problem.
One group that opposed your candidacy for district attorney in Los Angeles was, in fact, the police union.
Yep.
So why do you think that there's been so much opposition from people who I imagine used to be your colleagues and your friends at the LAPD? I mean, this must have been a tough pill to swallow, that the union that you were probably a part of is saying that they can't support you because you're too progressive. And how do you go about kind of repairing that relationship?
I always tell people that, you know, you sometimes have to follow the money. Prison guard unions and police unions in the last 30 years in this country have become incredibly politically powerful. And they had this very unique situation that other unions don't have, that they can further their goals of becoming bigger and more politically powerful by sort of disguising themselves behind the badge and say, I'm doing this because I want to protect you. And when you look at most of the policies that police unions push forward, have nothing to do with public safety. In fact, they often actually are detrimental to public safety. And I think that what happened in this cycle is that the public said, we had it with this stuff. I was running against the law and order candidate, and I won by 8%. And at the same time, there was a local county measure, Measure J, that actually talked about taking 10% from the discretionary budget from the sheriff's department and the probation and the district attorney and put that money into mental health service and social services, and that won. So I'm telling that to police. I said, look, reform is not only here, it's going to continue and it's going to move forward. And the options that you have, you either join this and become a problem solver and become a part of the solution, or you're going to get run over. You know, it's like sometimes progress is going to move regardless of whether you're there or not.
I just want to know, George, what, because you've kind of bopped about, you know, you from Havana to the barrios of Los Angeles to Mesa to San Francisco. You're back home now.
I am back home.
In LA.
Yeah.
What's it like to be back in your kind of home neck of the woods and being in this position of really tremendous power and the capacity to really make an impact on the state that, as you know, and a city and an area county that has a lot of influence in the rest of the country?
Yeah. You know, first of all, I love it. This is, you're absolutely right. This is home. And it's also full of contradictions like most of our country, right? You know, it's also extreme wealth and extreme poverty, right? We have the largest homeless problem in the country. The economic disparities have only accentuated themselves with COVID, right? So this is this great, crazy place with so much going on, and yet there's so much inequity. And you know, I'm hoping that I have at least put a little grain of salt towards, you know, having an impact on making things a little better.
Un granito de arena.
Un granito de arena.
George Gascon, thank you so much for speaking with me on Latino USA.
Thank you, Maria.
This episode was produced by Alisa Escarce and edited by Marta Martinez. The Latino USA team includes Miguel Macias, Andrea López Cruzado, Julieta Martinelli, Ginny Montalvo, Alejandra Salazar, and Reinaldo Leaños Jr., with help from Raúl Pérez. Special thanks to Fabiola Kramsky. Our engineers are Stephanie LeBeau, Julia Caruso, and Leah Shaw, with help from Elisheba Itu. Our digital editor is Luis Luna. Our New York Women's Foundation Ignite Fellow is Julia Rocha. Our interns are Jimena del Cerro, Emil Sequiros, and Gabriela Baez. Our theme music was composed by Zenia Rubinos. If you like the music you heard on this episode, stop by latinousa.org. Check out our weekly Spotify playlist. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again on our next episode. And in the meantime, I'll see you on all of our social media. Ahí los veo. Chao.
Latino USA is made possible in part by California Endowment, building a strong state by improving the health of all Californians. The Heising Simons Foundation, unlocking knowledge, opportunity, and possibilities. More at hsfoundation.org. And funding for Latino USA's coverage of A Culture of Health is made possible in part by a grant from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. Next time on Latino USA. This year, the holidays are looking a bit different. So how are we adapting to socially distant holidays? That's next time on Latino USA.